Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do schools need to change with the times in order to give students the best chance for success? 21st century jobs and the tools used to perform them are often radically different from their earlier iterations. And that suggests that the schools we have need to be very different as well to prepare students to be productive and creative members of society. Milton Chen has given the future of learning a great deal of consideration. He is senior fellow and former executive director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future, a national forum. That's a conference taking place tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. He joins us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Milton, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
All right, I'm going to start with a tough one. School reform is such a loaded term, right? Is there a way that we can talk about making schools better without sort of indicting the people who have been in the trenches for years trying to teach American students and who care very much? And I'm talking about teachers here.
Absolutely. And in all of this envisioning of the future of learning, the future of schools, teachers continue to be the single most important factor in the educational system. We think that teachers can be taking on new roles more as coaches and mentors and guides, especially when a lot of content that we want students to encounter and address and think deeply about, that's going to be available in digital forms and on the internet and some of our educational websites. But in this whole, I sometimes like to use the words school redesign or school reinvention, helping teachers understand their new role in all this is very important.
One of the things that you have argued for is breaking down the silos between different core subjects. Can you talk a little bit about how that might be done in ways other than saying your science term paper needs to have everything spelled correctly and use proper grammar?
Yes, in this new age, and we have, again, amazing sources of knowledge available on the internet to integrate across different subject areas. So it's sometimes called integrated studies, this approach to project-based learning rather than just textbook-based learning. So now we have these new tools to integrate across the subject areas and make the learning much more interdisciplinary or even multidisciplinary, so we don't just stop teaching mathematics when we encounter a scientific question. We can now integrate certainly across this new relatively recent phrase called STEM. We're trying to teach science, technology, engineering, and math together.
I read about you saying that nobody would think of trying to teach basketball with a textbook.
Yes.
Or strictly with a textbook.
Yeah, and I think that story says a lot because people instantly understand that we cannot teach our kids to play basketball by having them read a textbook. And if, in fact, your daughter came home one day and said, you know, and you asked her that typical question parents ask is, what did you do in school today? And they said, well, we learned to play basketball. And then she began to tell you that they learned to play basketball by reading a textbook about reading the first chapter on passing and learning the different kinds of passes. And if you eventually learned that they never actually got a basketball and went out on the court and played, parents would be marching on the school board tomorrow. They understand that physical education is about getting out there and doing that. And it should be the same thing in science. It should be the same thing in history. Actually doing real science, real history, investigating questions of interest in your own communities and in your own families. So we're trying to make the learning much more active and much more, we use the word authentic, connected to real lives.
Well, to take that example further, I also would not be confident that my daughter knew how to make the right split-second decision on the basketball court if she had taken a multiple-choice test, because that format has nothing to do with the way you would use your skills if you were learning to play basketball. And yet, it seems that these bubble tests are as close as we've figured out to an accurate, standardized assessment of people's skills.
Yes, redesigning assessment is probably the single most important thing we can do to lead schools into the 21st century, to have more authentic, more challenging assessments, and those are coming. So in all the school reform generations we've had going back 50 years now, we never really changed the tests. And if you don't change the tests, you don't change the instruction. What gets tested is what gets taught. And when that's tested on a multiple choice bubble test, then it encourages memorization and memorization of many unrelated facts. So that we're trying to change the assessments and really assessing real learning as you would in watching people play basketball and not just answer multiple choice questions about basketball. Rest assured that our best college players, our professional basketball players, they understand the rules of the game. They understand the different kinds of passes and the size of the court and how many points for a free throw. But that isn't where it ends. It ends with actually doing this on the court.
How do we need to think about memorization and its place in education today? If I always have a computer next to me, I might never need to know the date that the Civil War started in my head.
Yes, certainly the internet is now the place where we can go and quickly check facts, and that's a great thing in our learning, so that we can memorize and learn so many more facts more quickly. Still, in many disciplines, some memorization, some active use of knowledge and information is important, so memorization can still continue to play a role, but I would say a more diminished role from what it was when we were in school and when, again, knowing facts was equivalent to knowing knowledge.
On the other hand, it used to be that, you know, you and I were kids, we could go to the encyclopedia and trust that, you know, whatever year that encyclopedia had been completed, the information was pretty accurate, pretty balanced. I don't know whether that was actually true, but we were taught to believe it. Now, the sources of information that young people have are so broad and yet not necessarily trustworthy.
Yes, and that leads into the whole concept of digital literacy, being able to differentiate between sources of knowledge, being able to understand what are better sources of knowledge, being able to fact check, not just taking the first link that shows up in a internet search. Understanding that information comes in many different forms, some are better sources, being more critical of the sources of information, all that becomes part of a new kind of digital literacy we'd like our students to understand.
Do we need to give teachers training in how to teach these skills? For example, my children are often taught never to touch Wikipedia, that it's always wrong and that it can't be trusted. I use it on a fairly regular basis, but I know how to go and double check anything that doesn't look quite right. It seems like if you were taught 10 years ago in a seminar not to trust Wikipedia, you might still be operating under that sense that it's wrong.
Wikipedia is a good example of trying to promote digital literacy because it's true. If our students and really all users of Wikipedia understood how it's created, then that would lead them to say, well, you know, the entries here are put on by people who think they know and they're being cross-checked, but maybe not everything is current or maybe not everything is accurate. So again, being able to use multiple sources of information and going back to the days of the encyclopedia, not everything in the encyclopedia may have been as accurate or as, shall we say, unbiased,
right,
as we'd like it to be. So this is the age of multiple sources of information and trying to understand that you know, you need to differentiate between better sources and sources that aren't as reliable.
You've been a real champion of getting affordable digital devices into the hands of every school child in America, which it's interesting that this is controversial because almost every school child in America has access to that now. There's just a small percentage maybe that for economic reasons don't have access to these things. But what do you say to people who worry that students are just as likely to use these as a diversion from what they're supposed to be learning as a tool to find their way to learning?
The digital divide still exists, and it exists between schools. Even within schools in one district, there may be some schools that are better resourced where they've received some grants or the parents are helping to support digital tools for these students. And in the very same district, there will be schools where they don't have the same access. That is true between students of lower income backgrounds and the available technology that they have in their homes. And let's not forget that the time outside of the school day can be as important for students learning. And the afternoons, the weekends, the evenings, the summers, where kids can be learning using these tools. So that digital divide still exists, and we need to do more to provide these low-cost digital tools for roughly the cost of a textbook now. You know, in California, we pay $150, $175 for a single textbook. And now for about $200 per student per year, we can provide a digital device, a tablet or a PC, and training for the teachers, which is the most important factor, and broadband access to the internet. So we still need to close that digital divide. We still need to do more to provide these tools to every student. But that shift is happening, and the last 4 or 5 years have shown tremendous increase in the use of digital tools.
How do we encourage students to develop responsible use habits? A lot of adults struggle with being distracted from the task at hand by all the fun stuff online.
this comes up in every conversation. And now that we have brought the world of knowledge to students' fingertips, this idea of digital literacy and of knowing when to use it, how to use it, setting some limits on the use of screens becomes very important. The very same, I mean, the internet is full of course, so many sources of information and misinformation, both some very positive things that students can learn from, the Library of Congress website, the NASA website, but also some very negative and inappropriate things. So having students develop that sensibility about where they want to spend their time, how they want to spend their time, that's a very important part of these new digital habits and new digital literacy.
Are young people today really learning in a fundamentally different way than adults today did?
Yes, I think that today's students, we sometimes refer to them as digital natives because they were born digital. They've never used a typewriter. They've never used an audio cassette player. I remember using a typewriter, using an audio tape player. So these students are used to growing up digitally. They're used to having so many sources of information, so many things to do at their fingertips. They want a style of learning where they can access information. So when school districts are not able to provide these tools, the student, and they're throughout the history of this, students have had to hand in their cell phones when they enter high school. They have not been able to use digital devices, but that's shifting. So I do think that students want to learn in a different way. And importantly, they want to be able to share. They want to be able to work with each other. We sometimes call that the collaborative classroom. That's also a very different classroom from what most traditional classrooms have been, where if you shared your work with someone else or you looked and saw what they knew, that was called cheating. And now we want students very much to learn from each other and share their understandings and ask each other questions. And so students become not only learners, but also peer educators, peer teachers for each other.
When those collaborative learning experiences are happening, what do you do about the subset of students who are not that engaged in the subject? Maybe collaborative learning works really well for the ones who are willing to take the lead, but not as well for those who realize they can sort of sit back and relax.
Yes, and that's a good question that gets to your role as an active learner. We want, as we transition to this new kind of digital workforce, we want everyone in the workforce to be able to think of themselves as contributors, as active learners. You can think about the workplace and having people the same thing. You know, those students who weren't wanting to contribute, didn't feel like they were interested in the workplace 10 or 20 years from now. And, of course, we want them to be more curious, to preserve the curiosity they had as kids. So that ability to contribute and get interested, be curious, we can also now present a kind of learning environment where we can ask kids, well, if you're not interested in chemistry, for some reason you think that it doesn't apply to your life, we want to show you how it does apply to your life. So we can personalize the learning. We can ask students, well, if you think you're not interested in history, what are you interested in? Are you interested in yourself? Your family, your family's history, we can connect up American history to the story of your family here in this community.
Because there are alternative sources of information now that maybe weren't available before.
Exactly. We can send you to the local historical society. We can send you to genealogy sites. Again, the Library of Congress and Texas history. There's all these new sources that we can now connect up what you think you're interested in and the kind of subjects we're trying to teach.
We're speaking this hour with Milton Chen. He is a senior fellow and former executive director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future, a national forum that starts tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Milton Chen. He is a senior fellow and former executive director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation. He's in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future, a national forum taking place tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. And he is with us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. So, Milton, what happens at Learning Crossroads, and what kinds of voices are you bringing together?
Well, the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History is very interested in helping people understand the future of learning and this new learning landscape that we've entered into. So I give them a lot of credit for organizing this national forum. It's called Learning Crossroads, as you mentioned, and we have a number of great thought leaders coming in from around the country. They are heads of national associations such as the American Alliance of Museums, Ford Bell, or Bud Rock from the Association of Science and Technology Centers, as well as leaders in the museum world, Elizabeth Babcock from the California Academy of Sciences, and the library world. The new age of digital public libraries. Brian Bannon's coming in from the Chicago Public Library. And Sri Bose, also our local winner here of the inaugural Google National Science Fair, who's now a junior at Harvard. So a number of different perspectives on this learning crossroads that we're at, the new styles of learning that are now possible, and importantly, the role of institutions such as museums and libraries in helping schools partner and create this new kind of learning day and year. I like to say that now students can learn 24/7, 365, and schools operate in more of a 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 180 days a year. In fact, we have one of the shortest school years of most industrialized countries. Most countries go at least at 200, 220 days sometimes, and we're at 180. So these other institutions, libraries, museums, and others, Boys and Girls Clubs, can help step in and provide these kinds of learning experiences as well.
Are we too locked in as a society into the way things were done when we were kids?
Well, you could argue that, in fact, the schools are the last institutions to really change, given everything that's going on in healthcare, for instance, in manufacturing, in construction, just across the board in every sector of society, the internet and digital tools have changed how they do business. Much quicker access to information, teams working together to solve problems in the workforce. We just want schools to begin to emulate more of that modern way of organizing learning and work, and also have the schools then prepare students to work in that kind of an environment. And importantly, a lot of these environments are global. The internet makes learning international, and to be able to communicate instantly with people around the world, for students to learn other languages, talk to students in other countries, this is all now possible.
You've talked about leveraging the wasted moments that happen in every school day, things like the bus ride and places where right now we just assume that this is kind of lost time between two activities. Can you talk about some of the ideas you've heard about for really using that time?
Now with students with mobile devices, they can access information, and there are a number of school districts where the students have to travel. I mean, in most school districts, when they're on buses, they have to travel a good distance, half an hour, 45 minutes. But there are some more rural districts where the students travel an hour or two a day to get to school. And often when they're competing on sports teams, they will be traveling 3 or 4 hours on the weekend to get to a meet. And some of these districts, there have been some articles, for instance, the school districts in Arizona, where they equip the buses with Wi-Fi. And the students are able, you would think, oh my gosh, if they'll just be playing games and texting each other, and you know. But in fact, the students take it very seriously, and they know time is important there, and that the teachers can tell by when the students are submitting their assignments, oh, they were on a bus on Saturday when they did that work. So making this learning more 24/7 and anytime, anyplace learning, that's an important piece of this new learning landscape.
What is it about the one-on-one teacher-to-student experience that we can't fabricate or improve upon with digital technologies?
Teachers still are the most important person in this equation. There are some things that technology can do incredibly well, and we've seen it in terms of providing information, multimedia information, videos now to be able to see videos of, you know, sites in nature, for instance. But still, students need that human connection, and teachers provide that, especially the kind of social emotional learning. When a student's having trouble learning something, when they just need a pat on the back, Mr. Lucas, as the founder of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, was very good at summarizing this, where he said there are some things, and he was a technology innovator, there are some things that technology will never do, and it's giving that the student the pat on the back and saying, you know, you're good at this. Keep doing this. Or try talking with someone over here about that. It's that guide on the side and encouragement and mentoring that no computer will ever be able to do.
I want to talk a little bit about the folks who are now creating educational multimedia content. When I was a kid, I sat through a lot of really bad film strips, and we were still excited about them because they were something other than, you know, getting a lecture or something. But at the same time, there was educational programming starting to emerge that was compelling. And you spent years as director of research for Sesame Workshop. Can you talk a little bit about how research plays into the creation of the best educational content, to the extent that it doesn't necessarily feel educational when you're watching it?
Sesame Street still stands as the great model for this, now entering its 45th season on public television. It's quite amazing that the series continues and continues to innovate and continues to be one of the very best examples of combining research and creative design. So one of the earliest stories of what was then called formative research, where these segments were tested before they went on the air with preschool kids. Malcolm Gladwell has told this story in one of his books, that in the early test segments, there were animations, there were music segments, all very popular. Kids paid a lot of attention. But when it got to the street, the kids' attention declined because it was adults and kids talking. And there were no Muppets. And the producer said, well, we can't have this because some of the most important topics we're taking up about people getting along together, families of different backgrounds, if you can remember back to the 60s and 70s, it's still groundbreaking to see Hispanic families and African-American families and white families together talking. They said, we need to have kids understanding what we're trying to communicate. So that led to the creation of Big Bird on the Street, Oscar the Grouch. And it was based on that early feedback from viewers that they were paying less attention to those segments.
Hmm. So in other words, they would pay attention if there was someone colorful and then also absorb the idea that the neighbors are getting along.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, there are always some so-called educational experts who specialize in the current wisdom. And they did say, well, can kids of this age really distinguish them? Won't that be confusing to them to see an urban street scene and have Muppets, puppets, together with human characters? Won't they be confusing reality and fantasy? So it turned out that it went very well, and the kids were able to follow those segments. And in fact, some of the most important lessons about tolerance and getting along together were done on the street.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Joshua in Arlington. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. I have a comment about your guest's focus on, I guess I'd call it, fast collaborative education. And I think from my experience as a teacher in working class and elite educational contexts, primary, secondary, and university, I think is the promotion of this fast collaborative education further disadvantages working class students. Because if one looks at elite education systems, right, they are actually in sharp contrast to that. It's slow, like the slow food movement, right, taking time to think things through, and individualized, yeah? So my sense as a teacher in these different contexts and internationally as well is, frankly, I find a lot of these initiatives, like the fast collaborative stuff, to be promoted by snake oil salesmen and carpetbagging.
Milton, you want to respond to that?
Sure. No, thanks for that comment, Joshua. And while I do promote collaborative learning, I don't promote fast learning. I don't want it's true that there's a lot of information that students can access very quickly, but the goal of this is what some have called deeper learning. And when you look at the way in which some courses are structured, you know, the large survey courses in science or in history, Howard Gardner from Harvard has called this going from Plato to NATO in 30 weeks. So we don't want superficial learning. We want deeper learning. And you're absolutely right. We need to take our time. It can be a slower approach to learning, but I would use the term deeper learning. We want students to not just cover the curriculum, but to uncover the curriculum and understand the deeper connections between concepts. So I want to be clear that it's not just about I know that Sesame Street has been criticized, for instance, for being fast-paced in its approach to television as opposed to, say, Fred Rogers' program, which I've also worked with, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which was, I think, the epitome of slower learning. But we have learned that taking our time and presenting concepts clearly, giving students time to absorb what they're learning, all that's very important.
What about designing educational content for older children? I know that's even been an issue, an area in which PBS has struggled, right? You get them until they're about 8 or 9, and then suddenly it's not so cool to be watching the shows on PBS, and then you have this gap until they want to watch Downton Abbey and Ken Burns, the Roosevelts. What can we do to engage older learners with video content and the kinds of things that are working with younger children?
In fact, I spent a lot of time at Sesame Workshop designing programs for the 8 to 12-year-old audience. As kids were coming out of Sesame Street, and you may remember a reading show called The Electric Company, we designed programs in both science and math. 3-2-1 Contact was a PBS series for 8 to 12-year-olds about science, and Square One TV was about mathematics for the same age group. There are, again, in this day and age, so many ways of addressing the needs, the learning needs of these students. And once they have gotten past that fourth grade hump of being able to read for meaning, to be able to use language in more sophisticated ways, we should be giving them, in that age group of, say, 8 to 12 and even into the middle school years and the high school years, we should be giving them age-appropriate content as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Dasharov on the line now in Salt Lake. Hi, Dasharov.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the guest is, if you look at some of the civilizations, they basically pass knowledge from one generation to the next generation orally. Now we are actually taking that knowledge retention and knowledge transmission away, and we are actually externalizing it. It is basically at your fingertips. You don't have to index your knowledge or you don't have to retain. It is readily available. But the brain has evolved to basically facilitate knowledge retention and knowledge transmission. How new technologies have impact on human brain, on how it evolves?
Interesting question.
Well, you raise a good point, because I do want to clarify that in the midst of using all these internet tools and what they can bring to our learners, the art project by Google is a good example where kids can visit the world's great art museums. That was not possible before. You were limited to visiting the art museums in your own community. But Google has made that possible through the technology of actually riding down the hallways of the world's great art museums. So while it's true that there's a lot of great new sources of knowledge in pretty amazing ways, that personal connection that we were talking about earlier, the teacher's role, the way in which students can now meet and speak with others who are interested in topics, they can do that in person, they can do that online. One of my favorite examples of a project, how students can learn from their elders in the community, is a project at the National World War II Monument, where the students, high school students, interview and do video interviews and place them on the web. You can see them at the National World War II Monument in D.C., video interviews with our nation's veterans who've come to D.C. to their monument to see it, and they're often provided free flights and hotel rooms. It's called honor flights. But that's a great example of how students are able to use digital tools, record interviews with veterans, and learn in a first-person way, as you were suggesting, through an oral tradition of a veteran telling you what it was like to be there in Europe or in the Pacific during World War II. And they then place those video interviews online for the world to see. So that's a good example of the use of technology and 21st century tools, but also incorporating this very older form of sharing knowledge.
You're an advocate of bringing community members into the classroom where possible. How do we seamlessly integrate that so it doesn't feel like, okay, today we're not going to have social studies because we're bringing in, Mrs. X to talk about this? Do you understand what I'm saying? So in other words, it doesn't feel like something special and different from learning, but it really is integrated.
Yes, and part of this new 21st century classroom does involve the use of community experts, sometimes their parents, sometimes they could be museum curators, others, to come in and share the knowledge so that the teacher is not the only one sharing their knowledge. That's I sometimes call that the co-teaching edge. We want many more adults to interact with our students. And again, to the point of the caller, we want other adults to share their knowledge in person. And some of those connections can be made online as well. But at our website for the Lucas Foundation at edutopia.org, we have many, many examples of scientists, engineers coming in and showing how they use some of the same concepts that students are learning. So that's the great role of others coming in the classroom to show how this is actually used in real life.
That is asking a lot of teachers to write their lesson plans, to guide and grade their students, and also to sort of program a year of great guest speakers.
Yes, so this is where the partnership with institutions such as the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, art museums, groups of artists, bringing the arts back into the curriculum, across the curriculum, continues to be very important. So there are programs that districts can form with teaching artists, they come from musical companies, theater companies, who sometimes have that status of co-teaching along with the teacher. They may not be there for the entire school year, but for a period of weeks, they're helping to present these lessons and co-teaching with the teachers so that the individual teacher doesn't have to program that themselves, but it becomes part of their ongoing work of the school. One of my favorite programs that my own daughter benefited from was California Poets in the Schools. So this is a program where poets, and they're in every community, learn to work together with teachers and help the youngest kids learn to write poetry, which is one of the best examples of how our very youngest kids can learn to write.
My guest is Milton Chen. He is senior fellow and former executive director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future and National Forum, taking place tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th. Now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Milton Chen, senior fellow and former executive director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, who's in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future, a National Forum, taking place tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Milton, you mentioned the arts a few minutes ago, and this is one of those subjects that people think they're great if everything else is going swimmingly. But otherwise, many people think of arts programs as a luxury. What's your position on that?
Yes, and that reveals the kind of educational thinking that we've had where programs in the arts are sometimes thought about as extras, frills, and they're the first to be cut, when in fact they can be one of those most important ways to reach kids who aren't doing well. I've commented that our educational thinking needs to evolve where we don't – if kids aren't doing well on the test, sometimes what we think about is, oh, well, they're not doing well in this kind of classroom. We just need them to have more of that, when in fact these kids who aren't doing well in class may need something very different. And the arts are a great way. We see so many kids who want to draw, who want to express themselves through the arts, through music, through performance, through theater. These are ways in which we can get them to the arts, and then through that we can get them back to literature, to history. Shakespeare is a great example of that, and science as well. There's in fact a history of science that many people are unaware of, and saying, "Well, you know, we can actually teach a lot of history through looking at how science developed."
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Andrea on the line in Plano. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As I'm listening to Milton Chin speak, I was thinking about the Montessori school program, and it reminded me a lot about Montessori schools, learning through hands-on, learning through projects, learning through guest speakers, and even the art that was just spoken. And I wanted to know, Mr. Chin, your philosophy on the Montessori school.
Well, it still stands as one of the great models in education, and unfortunately it's been thought of as something only for the preschool age student, when in fact if we were, as you're suggesting, take some of those ideas and extend them through the K-12 schools, through project-based learning, through hands-on learning, it's really a great model for what we should see in schools as well.
When we are designing digital curricula, what do we need to think about? Many people are familiar with the fact that MOOCs were very exciting a few years ago, and they still are thought to maybe have some potential, but they haven't really yielded the results that most people had hoped they would.
Yes, and when you think about these massive online courses given by a number of universities, of course, that to actually complete that course, you have to do a lot of work and you have to be pretty well prepared and you have to be pretty persistent. A lot of folks, I was one of them, just kind of came in for the first few talks to see what it was about, but more as an informal learning experience, not to actually complete the course. So as we think about how we can design digital learning for the future, there are all sorts of ways in which we're trying to provide more support for students as they go through a course. That, again, as I was suggesting, that interpersonal connection is as important as just seeing the lecture or getting that little piece of tutorial. The Khan Academy, for instance, has been very successful in helping break down concepts, and so students can hear them more than once, see them more than once, and repetition becomes important in learning in a way in which we haven't perhaps valued that as much. But there are great ways, for instance, of new tools for teaching students about language, being able to translate from one language to another, being able to have the language spoken. Google Translate's an amazing tool for learning language, and we're seeing that it's also an amazing tool for incorporating and involving more parents of different backgrounds who may not be as comfortable in English, but through Google Translate, they're getting the information from the school in up to 60 different languages.
How do we cultivate the idea in our students that learning is not over when you get that high school diploma? It's not over when you get that college degree. It's not over when you get your first job. It continues. It seems that our society is sort of divided between people who continue to want to engage with learning and people who think that was something they did a long time ago.
Encouraging this love of learning,
yeah.
This curiosity that we were all born with, and you see it in our youngest kids, in 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, and as they enter school, keeping that sense of curiosity alive is so important. So we want all learners to be lifelong learners. That's the coin of the realm these days, to even when you're in the workforce, to be interested in learning new skills, to be curious about that particular field that you're involved with. So we want schools to encourage that, to emulate that, and we want to show that especially this connection between what you're learning in school and how it applies in real life, that can be one of the most motivating things for students, to know that what I'm learning today is actually used by real people in different fields.
Are there better ways to measure student progress than what we're doing right now?
There's no question that we're moving into a new age of assessing learning. This kind of deeper learning, we have the Common Core State Standards and new forms of assessment coming out for them. So that's the hope, as I was suggesting earlier. Once we change those assessments, we'll have a deeper form of learning, and also coming up with new forms of certifying the learning. There's a movement to create what are known as badges of learning that are very much based on the idea of Scout badges. So this was a form of learning and achievement that happened outside of schools, and everyone who was a Boy Scout or a Cub Scout or a Girl Scout or a Brownie remembers having a badge for camping, for science, for doing a science project. And that idea is being extended into all sorts of new ways of learning. Some museums are leading the way. Libraries are leading the way. And at the Digital Future Forum tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, Anmei Chung from the Mozilla Foundation is an expert in this new form of certifying learning beyond the courses and grades. Can we have badges that where you actually see what students learn, and then they're being used by employers to actually validate what prospective employees actually know?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Bruce in Keller. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a question. It would seem that we are importing a lot of brain power from other educational systems around the world, and I would like the your guest to see if he can put his brain around that and give us an answer as to why. Why are we accepting the product of other educational systems rather than our own? What's the matter with our own?
Well, you raise an important point, and on these international comparisons in math and science and language arts, the United States is generally in the middle, around 15th or 20th place compared to other smaller, less diverse countries like Finland and Singapore. I live very near Silicon Valley, where it's true. We are importing a lot of talent from Asia, from the UK, and we need to grow our own. And in our comparisons with other countries, one of the great things that we have, while we're a much bigger country, a much more diverse country, we do have this system of institutions in addition to our formal education systems, our schools and universities, and our universities continue to be the envy of nations around the world. And you see so many foreign students and professionals coming to our universities. But it's our K-12 systems that need to change and become more modern, and they can do that through these kind of partnerships with museums and libraries. And we have the world's envy when it comes to museums, when it comes to libraries. I've been working a lot with the national parks, which are being mentioned a lot with the PBS series on the Roosevelts right now and Teddy Roosevelt's role in creating the national park system. By getting kids into nature, by getting kids into these places where they can experience something very different from their own communities and really understand the awe and wonder and beauty of nature in our national parks that belong to all of us, that's also something, an experience we want to give our students.
To what extent would you ascribe the challenges in the American educational system to poverty? Because it seems that students who are from middle-class backgrounds tend to do okay, and students from poorer families are the ones who are struggling.
Certainly, if you go by the current, more conventional measures, poverty is a big factor, no question. That's why we want to close the digital divide. We want to give kids a level playing field where all students have, just as they had access to a textbook in the traditional classroom, they have access to these new digital tools. But the bar has been raised for all students, not just in this country, but around the world. A higher bar is there around creativity, around innovation. It's not enough even for our students from middle and upper income families. Often they are at risk for being successful in this new modern creative economy. For instance, and it all comes down to the assessments. When we judge our students based on the SAT, we judge them based on their high school transcript, often they haven't had to grow anything, put their hands in dirt, go out into nature, learn how the ecosystem works. But when they get into the workforce and we're dealing with new sources of energy, we're dealing with creating new kinds of products and services, they need to have more of that authentic experience. And that's where this concept of project-based learning comes in. We want to see more of these projects where kids are out in their communities learning in a more hands-on way. That's the key to their educational futures, and that's for students of all backgrounds.
I don't know that you've written anything on this, but I'm curious as to your opinion. The shrinking recess hour, we're so worried about taking instructional time away. Is it important that kids have some time to run around in the middle of the day, or is that something that we need to just live without?
Here I think parents know best, and every parent will say, of course, our children need recess. And it's unfortunate that, again, in our educational thinking, and if we think that they're not doing well on the tests, we need more instructional time. But it's the same kind of an instructional time. Sometimes when our kids are not doing well, we say, well, we're not giving them enough of what they are not getting. But in fact, these kids need something very different. So recess time, physical activity is important. The arts are important. These kids need a different kind of experience, and that's what I'm advocating for in these kinds of schools of the future.
What do we do to cultivate the skills of our best teachers, or all of our teachers?
Well, that's the great thing. And I mean, you look at what other countries, Finland is often pointed to, Singapore is often pointed to at the very top of these international comparisons. When you ask them, how did you create a very high-performing national educational system for a nation of maybe 5 or 10 million people, they will say, well, we just studied you. We studied the best of what the United States is doing, your best teachers, your best classrooms, your best students, where they're getting this kind of hands-on, authentic, project-based approach. They're able to leverage learning time outside of the school day. So our best teachers continue to be models of what the best education can be. And in fact, when you break down these international comparisons and begin to have American states look at just their states, certainly Massachusetts and Colorado are very high-performing states on their own in these international comparisons.
How do we compare with our spending on public education as compared with GDP?
In fact, we spend a fair amount compared to other countries on K-12. In fact, if the average is getting close to $10,000 per student per year, many countries spend less than that. What they do is have a very different system of preparing teachers. For instance, in Finland, the teachers are actually given a stipend to learn to be teachers. They select their teachers from the very best students. They are paid an appropriate salary commensurate with other professionals. So we have a long ways to go in honoring the teaching profession and compensating teachers to really do this kind of new knowledge work.
I don't know if you're contractually obligated to be device agnostic, but I wonder if you think there is a particular kind of device or platform that is best. If we were to hand a device to every student in America, would it be a smartphone? Would it be a laptop? Would it be a tablet computer? Does it matter?
Clearly, the trend is supporting mobile computing. We want students to have devices that they can carry with them between the home and the school. They're called one-to-one programs where every student has their own device, but they have to leave it at the school. I once met a medical school student who had his laptop in his backpack, and I said, well, that's great that you're able to carry it around. He said, well, why would I want to leave it behind in the computer lab? This laptop is part of my brain. Hmm. I need to have it with me wherever I go, and I think that's the right model.
And do you think that American students are excited about technology? There aren't too many young people who aren't thrilled to have those devices enhance their education.
Well, clearly, this is a generation of students that are just born digital. They're used to having these devices. What we want them to learn is to use these devices for more powerful learning and not just socializing and Facebooking.
Milton Chen is Senior Fellow and former Executive Director of the George Lucas Educational Foundation in town for Learning Crossroads, the Digital Future, a national forum taking place tomorrow at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. Milton, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. By the way, we had Addie Sun on the phones with us today. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.